The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Rick Lines is the executive director of Harm Reduction International. Rick has been working in HIV and harm reduction services, policy, and advocacy since the early 1990s and is known for his leading work in the areas of HIV in prisons, prison needle-slash-syringe programs, and human rights and the death penalty for drug offenses. His first book, Drug Control and Human Rights in International Law, was published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. It is a tremendous honor to have Rick as a guest on Century this week. The first question, of course, that I had for Rick was to simply tell us more about Harm Reduction International and how that organization got started and some basic background.
We engage primarily at the international level doing research, policy analysis, and advocacy. And also act as a bit of a catalyst to help coordinate joint campaigning and advocacy with our harm reduction partners working at international, national, and regional level around the world to try to promote further adoption of harm reduction practices and trying to promote approaches to drug laws and drug policies that respect, protect, and fulfill human rights.
And so you have a new book out. It is relatively new. It's from Cambridge University Press. And before I ask you about that, you are currently, if I'm reading your Twitter correctly, you're currently in Geneva at the 41st UNAIDS Program Coordinating Board meeting.
I'm not personally, but several members of my team are there. So Harm Reduction International is very definitely present and involved at that meeting, but not me this time. I'm in London today.
All right. Well, what's going on over there in Geneva?
Well, the Program Coordinating Board is essentially the board of directors of UNAIDS, which is the Joint United Nations Program on Addressing HIV. And the Program Coordinating Board meets a couple of times a year to help shape the direction of what UNAIDS is doing, also receive feedback and input from various member states, from the NGO delegation, which is quite strong there, from people living with HIV and AIDS who are part of that delegation. And, of course, we attend on a regular basis to make sure that harm reduction and issues of HIV and injecting drug use remain on the agenda of UNAIDS and other UN agencies, and don't get sort of lost in the discussions that happen. So we're there this week to continue to fly the flag of harm reduction.
Fantastic. Now, that's the sort of silo approach that the UN has for some of these, and the sort of cross-cutting issues that need those silos taken down. UNODC, we have the drug control regime and yet human rights is a separate element. The balancing human rights and drug control seems to be an ongoing struggle internationally. What should a good balance between drug control and human rights look like?
Well, first and foremost, we should never have any drug control interventions that violate human rights, full stop. Unfortunately, what we've seen up until really recently is that discussions and development of drug laws and drug policies have never really taken into account human rights. And at the same time, human rights organizations and human rights bodies within international organizations such as the UN have typically shied away from examining issues of drugs. A lot of it just has to go to the siloing kind of reality that you've talked about, where different organizations focus on a very limited way on their mandates and not outside of that. Part of it speaks to just the degree to which drugs have been completely stigmatized and criminalized and securitized over the last number of decades, to the degree that drug control wasn't even seen as having any human rights relevance. It was strictly, you know, about law enforcement and fighting bad drug traffickers and trying to rescue people who use drugs. And that's thankfully something that's begun to shift over the last 10 years or so, primarily driven by civil society and NGOs, ours amongst another, you know, a group of them focusing on those issues. Been raised by certainly the voices of people who use drugs and the networks that represent them. Also some of the organizations working in producer countries, looking at the issues of peasant farmers and growers. The work that we've really pioneered on the issue of the death penalty for drugs, looking at abuse of law enforcement in the context primarily of drug trafficking. All of these things, again, primarily being led by civil society, but with some very important assistance and support along the way from key human rights leaders and human rights bodies, have begun to shift that mechanism, to shift that discourse. Certainly the UN Office on Drugs and Crime is much more open to that sort of discourse now than they were 10 years ago. Moving from the rhetoric to the operationalization, of course, is a different a different thing altogether. We see many, many more human rights bodies taking on drug control issues. We see drug issues having a much higher prominence within a lot of the major human rights NGOs. So certainly human rights and drug control, the nexus between those is certainly something that's much, much more prominent now than it was 10 years ago when I began sort of the work that ended up in that book. But still, there's still a large gap in implementation. In many ways, the last couple of years, we've seen the situation in a number of key countries, from, you know, sort of the Philippines to Indonesia to the United States, sort of going backwards. So these situations are far from resolved. But certainly the human rights impacts of drug enforcement and drug control is something that's much more on the agenda now. So at least there is room to start pushing on some of those things.
And as I recall from of course, the CND meetings are webcast live, only webcast live. They don't keep those in an archive. It's really sad. But on some of these I've seen among the Russian delegate, I believe, and forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, but I seem to recall hearing the Russian delegate and possibly a couple of others say that the basic human right is to be living in a world that's free from all drugs. Or possibly it was our attorney general. I get them mixed up sometimes.
Those definitely aren't mutually exclusive. That is actually something you hear from a variety of places. Really, in response to the success and the traction that, you know, our sector has had in beginning to highlight human rights and drug control issues, that has been one of the standard pushbacks we've seen from some member states, from kind of the, you know, the zero tolerance and abstinence based NGO sector, and also even from the International Narcotics Control Board on more than one occasion, sort of creating this right to be drug free as the kind of, I guess, opposite to looking at drug control policies that promote the right to health and, you know, prohibit torture and inhuman and degrading treatment, protect and promote the rights of women and young people, et cetera, or don't violate those rights. So you're not alone to being confused where you might have heard that, because it's likely you heard it more than one place.
I think that as far as drug policy reformers, we've gotten better, I think, and more effective, because we have been bridging the gap between policy advocacy and the people who use drugs, advocating for actually people who use drugs, rather than seeing them as others. It strikes me that it's easy to violate the rights of an other. It's easy to abuse an other. It's difficult if you think of them as a person, you know, someone who's in your community. And the organizing of people who use drugs, that's something that's been accelerating in the past few years. Am I just noticing it more?
No, absolutely. It's something that's definitely been accelerating again over the last 10 years. And I've always said to my colleagues who do that work that I think, you know, the presence of organized groups of people who use drugs at these various national and international and regional policymaking meetings are not just critical in the sense of having the voices of affected populations at the table. I think they're actually critical for exposing kind of the fallacy at the base of so much prohibitionist drug law, which is essentially that people who use drugs are not capable of autonomous decision making. People who use drugs are chemical slaves, the kind of language we hear, that somehow they're, you know, helpless victims of their drug addiction. So having, you know, articulate, intelligent, strategically minded organizations of people who use drugs around the table actually exposes kind of the whole fallacy of that kind of rationale for policymaking. You know, the fact that you can actually be a person who used just drugs and take part, you know, at a very high level meeting, you know, be very very engaged, you know, very aware of the issues going on, be able to comment at a high level on policy, be networked in internationally with your partner organizations, again, just exposes the lie about, you know, that really underpins so much of punitive drug control.
Some of the things that are going on in the U.S., we're finding that, well, and all over the world, harm reduction advocates have often found that it's necessary to bend the rules somewhat, or even just break the bloody law where it's necessary. Things like syringe exchange. In our country, syringe exchange is tolerated at all levels, really, but not really legal on many levels, depending on the jurisdiction. Safe consumption sites. A number of cities around the U.S. are talking about setting up a safe consumption site. It's absolutely going to be against the law to do it now, but there are some folks doing that now. How much of the advance that's been made has been in spite of the law rather than because of it?
Oh, I think a significant amount. I think if we look at, you know, the development of harm reduction in, you know, many, many, many countries, you know, the start of harm reduction was community-based activism in a lot of places. You know, whether that's people who use drugs or people who are doing broader kind of HIV or street health services, beginning to take it upon themselves to distribute syringes, as you say, or to set up safe places for people to inject indoors so they don't have to inject in back alleys or in parks and increase the risk of overdose. You know, begin to provide access to overdose reversal medications, often before those are actually generally available or licensed. I mean, that's part and parcel of a lot of the HIV activist movement generally, when we've seen that in sort of treatment activism, people bringing medication from one country to another at different stages in time in the HIV response. So there's always been that burning sort of righteous cause within the HIV movement generally and the harm reduction movement about, you know, we will not let, you know, bad laws and abusive laws get in the way of our efforts to save lives. And, you know, people have been obviously persecuted and prosecuted for that in many countries in the past. I know that continues to go on in the United States at the state level at some places where syringe exchange workers can be charged with various offenses. But in many places, we see that that activism has been incredibly important in creating that political space that actually results in changing laws. So, I mean, that sense of community spirit, that sense of activism, and, you know, and not being willing to just be constrained by what are really, you know, ridiculous laws, you know, in the face of massive public health problems and, you know, the deaths of thousands of people. I think that's one of the real, righteous elements of the whole HIV and harm reduction movement, and something we should all be proud of.
Now, of course, in this here in the U.S., where I live, we're looking at the possibility of turning the clock back. I mean, the you know, opioid commission, yay, we're going to do something. Everything's law enforcement. Oh. It looks like we're going, basically, a question of not having learned lessons of the past. What kind of advice would you have for policymakers here in the U.S.?
Well, I think the point you've made is really at, you know, kind of at the heart of what I look at, or the challenge at the heart of the, you know, the book that I wrote, which is the fact that, you know, drug control, you know, as a cause or as a, you know, a logic or as a body of law, certainly is an ideology that justifies and centralizes the authority of the state. essentially. Whereas human rights, obviously, is a body of law and a philosophy that seeks to minimize the encroachment of the state into the lives of people and into the lives of communities. So there's a fundamental conflict, you would say, between, you know, the one body of laws that justifies and extends state control and one that seeks to push it back. And I think that's not surprising that we're seeing what we're seeing in the United States at the moment, given the current administration and the current administration's obsession with control. Of course, in the United States, we've seen very clearly the impacts of that control and the racialized impacts of that abusive form of drug control, which is an important thing to emphasize when we talk about, you know, human rights and drug control issues. We very correctly, I think, look at the abuses against people who use drugs, the abuses against people in prison for drug offenses, the people, peasant farmers who are cultivating coca, for example, or opium in different parts of the world. But the reality is, I think in most countries of the world, the people who are affected by drug laws are disproportionately people who don't use drugs. Again, I mean, the United States is a good example of this. When we look at, you know, the incredibly authoritarian and militarized policing that we see in communities of color and poor communities across the United States, that's abusive powers that affect everyone living in that community, regardless of whether they have any relationship to the drug market. And that's where, again, where we get back to that question of drug control as a way of legitimizing state power and the authoritarian tendencies of the state. So, again, that is really a central element that makes it difficult to have some of these discussions, because certainly from a harm reduction perspective, we always have to focus on the public health successes of harm reduction and how harm reduction saves lives, how harm reduction saves the state money by preventing disease, saves the lives of people who might otherwise be vulnerable. But at the same time, when you start to scratch too far, you get into these questions of the state having to surrender a certain degree of power, which they've enjoyed over the years, certainly enjoyed through the advances in the drug control regime and the militarizing of that regime at national level in many countries. So harm reduction very quickly runs up against, that security mindset in many countries. And while it's incredibly important to argue the public health rationales and evidence in that regard, when you get to kind of broader questions of enforcement and change of laws, we obviously have a much different kind of hill to climb.
You are listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. My guest this week is Rick Lines. He is the executive director of Harm Reduction International and the author of Drug Control and Human Rights in International Law, which is published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. Let's get back to that interview. Tell me about your book, Drug Control and Human Rights in International Law. It was released by Cambridge University Press a couple of months ago. Law school text. Talk to me about your book.
I would say it's definitely sort of a scholarly book in tone, but hopefully it's not inaccessible. I try not to write anything I do in a way that's inaccessible. So while it's not necessarily an academically toned book, I would say it certainly is a book that would appeal to people who work in our sector. It's not a piece of popular literature that someone who had no interest in drug control is going to pick up as their first entry point into discussions of drugs and harm reduction. It is an international legal text in that regard. The basic question it looks at is how do you resolve conflicts between international drug control law and international human rights law? I think the frustration that I had that led to the book is sort of something you articulated about this right to be drug-free or right to live in a drug-free society, is the number of times you see governments defending abusive drug policies. And I sort of got into it through the death penalty, which is one of the main issues that I've been working on for the last 10 or 12 years, the death penalty for drug offenses. You see governments justifying abusive drug policies, whether that's a death penalty, whether that's mass incarceration, whether that's random urine testing, all these sorts of intrusive technologies are justified on the grounds that, well, we are doing this to fulfill our obligations in international law. around drug control. And I just said, well, that's just a nonsense. So we need to actually look at a way and try to come up with a framework whereby we can sort of pick apart that rationale and not let that rationale stand. Basically, what I do in my book is examine through a number of case studies, one of them being the death penalty, one being harm reduction, one being traditional uses of coca, which are sort of the three main issues that tend to come up time and time again in the international debates. Look at what a human rights-based approach at national level would look like. What happens when you run into conflicts between the law, and are these actually conflicts in law? Because in many times they're not. I mean, the question of the death penalty for drugs is not a conflict of law in the traditional sense. Like, there's nothing in international drug control law that says states must execute drug traffickers. That's, you know, what it is. It's the state using kind of the ideology and rationale of punitive drug control as a way to justify their policy. So I really just sort of try to tease out some of those ideas and look at a framework or creating a framework for interpretation of treaties that could be used in national courts, for example, or by parliamentarians or congresspeople to balance their international commitments in both regimes in a way that always protects and promotes human rights first and foremost. I mean, the book in itself is sort of part looking at the history of the development of the drug control regime, part looking at individual case studies of different key human rights issues, and then part looking at some sort of legal frameworks and legal tests about how we might resolve these real and perceived conflicts in a way that protects human rights.
I know that you've got some things you need to get to. While we still have a minute, though, I mean, death penalty for drug law violations is a horrendous idea because the death penalty is a stupid idea in the first place. But that's imposing a death penalty on someone who's been tried, convicted. At least there is some pretense at a rule of law. The Philippines, the last count I saw was something like 12,000 people who've been murdered in that country in just the last year and a half. Under the pretense of a drug war, could you talk for a moment about the Philippines?
Sure. Well, what we're seeing in the Philippines is just nothing other than widespread state-sanctioned criminality at an extreme level, and it's a very good example of what I said earlier about drug control being an ideology. And a framework that solidifies and legitimizes the authority of the state. Because really, in many ways, and we see the more and more reports that come out of the Philippines, we see this is that that the so-called war on drugs in the Philippines has increasingly little to do with anything about drugs. Drugs is the rationale or the kind of blanket excuse that gets thrown over it. But it's really just an excuse for the regime in power to eliminate poor people and undesirable people, political opponents. We've obviously seen threats against journalists and parliamentarians and human rights defenders who even speak out against the mass killings. So drug control and drug enforcement and drug suppression is kind of the coloring around it. But at the end of the day, it's just sort of naked state oppression being acted out under the guise of drug enforcement. Of course, even if it was drug enforcement, it would be completely illegitimate and completely criminal. But again, it is unfortunately an example where we see the excuse of fighting drugs being used to justify all manner of absolutely horrific state crimes.
Indeed. Hashtag boycott the Philippines. Are there some other countries? I understand Indonesia is also looking at following a sort of a Philippine model. Are there any other countries that are heading down that road?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're seeing a lot of, quite frightening backsliding in a number of places. I mean, Indonesia began about 3 years ago or so when they reinstituted the death penalty by executing, I think it was 12 drug offenders in 1 year. And yes, this was about after a period of about 5 years when Indonesia hadn't executed really anyone. And sort of the assumption in the anti-death penalty movement was that Indonesia was quietly moving towards a moratorium because they'd really gone from a period of time of being a very high-level execution state to really executing. I think they executed two people over the course of 5 years. So it was a marked change in government policy, which then switched back with the election of the new president there. And of course, as you say now, there's discussion about emulating a Philippines model. So we've seen the backsliding there is very, very frightening. You've mentioned the United States, of course, where we have been seeing some good things in drug policy, both at the national level and in terms of the U.S.'s engagement within international drug control discussions. We saw a big change between the Bush and the Obama administrations on that. Of course, that's now backsliding now with the new Attorney General and the big question mark over what's going to happen now with the legalized state markets. Still remaining to see how negative this is going to be at the international level, whether we'll see sort of the U.S. Sort of siding again with Russia and others, the more reactionary states at the international level, whereas under Obama, the U.S. had sort of backed off from that and at least become quiet on a lot of the more contentious discussions, if not friendly to some more harm reduction language. Yeah, so it's a very, despite some of the changes and advances that we've seen in the discourse about drugs and human rights in some of the international level that I've talked about, where there are some very, very worrying trends at national level, which shows sort of the degree to which this fight to end the war on drugs and the fight to end the human rights abuses linked to the war on drugs is certainly not going away, and it's really escalating, and the need for vigilance and campaigning is as strong as ever.
You do such brilliant work, and I'm just grateful as to heavens. Again, folks, we're speaking with Rick Lines, the Executive Director of Harm Reduction International. Professor Lines, you're visiting professor. You've got a couple of appointments. Oh, you're a professor. You have a PhD, too. Really a brilliant guy. Again, the book, which just came from Cambridge University Press a couple of months ago, Drug Control and Human Rights in International Law. Harm Reduction International has a website. If you could direct us toward that, and also if you have any closing thoughts for our listeners.
The website is www.hri.global, G-L-O-B-A-L. And certainly you can find all of our materials there, looking at international harm reduction, looking at our death penalty work, our human rights work, our work on tracking international and national funding support for harm reduction. Anyone who's interested in kind of international drug policy or international harm reduction, I'm sure will find something of interest on the site. And just thanks a lot for having me on, Doug. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, and I'd love to do it again sometime.
That was my interview with Rick Lines, the Executive Director of Harm Reduction International. His book, Drug Control and Human Rights in International Law, was published by Cambridge University Press in summer of 2017 and is available from wherever you purchase books, and I highly recommend it. Their website at hri.global. It's an excellent resource. Well, I want to thank you very much. That's it for this week. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.